Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
At Founders Brewing Company, we set out to create a beer that lets you embrace the unconventional. Mortal Bloom is a radiantly beautiful, hazy IPA that will wrap your taste buds with intense citrus and tropical notes of pineapple and mango. Coming in at 6.2% ABV with big aromatics and no bitterness, it's the perfect beer, if we do say so ourselves. Visit foundersbrewing.com to find Mortal Bloom Hazy IPA.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Podcast One presents the Steve Austin Show Classics.
Scott Hall is my guest today. And man, I tell you what, this guy has cut a very interesting path through the career that he's had in professional wrestling. He's a guy that I was a big mark for as I was going through the business, watched everything he did. A guy with wonderful coordination and movement in the ring for a big cat. And a guy that really never worked technically like a big guy would bump for anybody, but in the right doses. To those of the Steve Austin Show listeners who don't know who Scott Hall is, I'm going to read a little gimmick off Wikipedia. Scott Oliver Hall is a former American professional wrestler well known for his tenure with World Wrestling Federation, now known as WWE, under the ring name Razor Ramon, and with the World Championship Wrestling under his real name, Scott Hall. Since his 1985 arrival in the American Wrestling Association, Hall maintained a perennially high profile as a wrestler, attaining 9 World Tag Team Championships, 4 Intercontinental Championships, and 2 United States Championships as well. We're not going to go to that other stuff. Anyway, without any further ado, you guys know him as Razor Ramon, the bad guy. Scott Hall, welcome to the show.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Man, how are you? What's going on down there? You're in Atlanta, correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. On the outskirts of Atlanta in Smyrna, Georgia.
Man, bring us up. This has been an interesting thing, Scott, because you and I go back a long time, and you're a little bit older than me, and as long as you were in the business and as long as I was in the business, we never really crossed paths too much. Now, certainly we worked a program together in WrestleMania 18, and we'll get to that. But in trying to set up your appearance on the Steve Austin Show, you and I traded a lot of phone calls and just started talking and talking and talking and couldn't shut up. I've enjoyed getting to know you just talking to you on the phone.
Well, thanks. Back at you, Steve. It's been a pleasure. Yeah. I remember crossing paths. I think I was already gone doing Razor when you were in WCW. Like, you came in right when Dally was there and I was there doing that stud thing. And then when you were when you had that sweet ringmaster gimmick going with DiBiase.
Thanks.
I was just kind of leaving the Razor gimmick to go see what lay waiting for me in WCW. But no, I also have enjoyed the phone calls, man. It's been great.
Hey, let me ask you a question. You bring that up, and like I told him, me and Scott were talking. We're calling this whole sumbitch in the ring right here. I'm going to hit him from stuff from the present, the past, the future. I've got a lot of fan questions that we're going to ask as well, because I asked you guys to send some questions to questions@steveaustinshow.com, and you did. But what did you think when you see a cat like me, and I was stunning Steve for a long time, and all of a sudden I switched to the ringmaster as one of the boys and one of the guys that I respected? What did you think when I turned into the ringmaster? Like, what in the hell is Austin doing? Or, this is money. What was going through your mind?
Well, Steve, to be honest with you, I felt that Vince didn't know what to do with you. You know, obviously you had great ring skills, good presence, good mic skills, but they didn't know what to do with you at that time. So I think they did the best they could, try to give DiBiase something to do too, but it's just, I mean, I don't know. Have you ever hung out with Ted? I mean, I love Ted, but I'm thinking, I don't see you guys hanging out. So the package to me wasn't that sellable to the fans.
Well, you know, and I had actually talked to Vince a couple of times on the telephone, and I, you know, didn't even want to come to WWF initially because I knew that they had nothing for me. It wasn't until after I'd torn my tricep and, you know, hey, then I needed a job, and he called when I was working for ECW that I took that ringmaster offer. But I was on the same page with you, man. I knew it was a bad gimmick, but it was a foot in the door, but I just wondered what a cat like you would think about it. But, hey, let's talk about the here and now. You just got hip surgery. When a couple of months ago?
Yes, sir. April 9th. So it's been, you know, well, today's the 22nd of July. I guess it's going to air later. But, yeah, a little over 4 months. And, Steve, I'm so happy to report that I'm healing ahead of schedule. And I just feel so lucky, man. I'm so blessed.
Well, what all did they do to your hip? Out of all the stuff I've had done, Scott, you know, I've never had an issue with hips. So was the thing completely out? Was it bone on bone in the socket? What's the story with the hip?
Yeah, it was crazy. The left one was completely shot while the right one was pristine, completely, you know, fine. And the option was try to save the bone and just do like a resurfacing kind of deal, or just go with the real, more radical total replacement. And the doctor was going to try to do the less serious procedure, but when he got inside, he just decided to go total replacement. So I'm bionic now, man. Between the heart surgery I had in 2010 and with the pacemaker defibrillator gimmick I got in 2010 in Houston, and now with this bionic hip, I don't know, man. I'm thinking about getting everything done, Steve, just getting everything replaced because I feel so good. I might just go totally mechanical.
Hey, man, let's talk about your heart. I remember, you know, hearing about that and then, you know, seeing some stuff on YouTube. But what was the issue with your heart? How are you now? Is that thing healthy? Will you always have that defibrillator inside you?
Although I got to admit, the last checkup I had, there was one cardiologist who recommended having the device turned off. And I got to admit, he was a guy, though, Steve, who filled in on weekends, you know, and he wasn't like my normal guy.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, I don't know, bro, that thing sure did work when I needed it. You know, it kicked in and saved my life. I had, Steve, through my poor choices and reckless lifestyle, had drunk myself into heart disease. So I was able to get some surgery on Vince's dime. Thank you to the WWE and Vince and Linda and Stephanie and Paul and, you know, Shane. Thank you for your kindness. And since then, though, you know, I still wasn't doing all the right things, so my heart was suffering. And I had an episode where my gimmick, my defibrillator, just started firing, bro. Like, I mean, like, bang. And it hurts because normally somebody's, like, dead or, like, passed out when you shock them, like, clear. I was, like, wide awake, and that thing went off a couple times. And since then, man, that booze does not look so good to me.
Hey, but
you know, when I got to Atlanta, I was taking 15 meds every morning. Now I take 4. So the heart's good, the hip is good, the head is getting where it needs to be. I'm happy to report I'm all good.
Well, if you if moving into the future and they say, hey, man, let's take this, whether they take the thing out or leave it in, right now, as long as you're staying on your protocol and staying away from the booze and the pills and all the other stuff, you're good to go. I mean, you know, with anything could happen, lightning could strike, but, you know, you can live a long life, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's a worn-out cliche, but I like it. You know, in the words of Mickey Mantle, if I didn't know not to, you know, live this long, I'd have taken better care of myself. But, yeah, I'm, you know, only the good guy, only the good die young, Steve, so I think I'll be around for a long time.
There you go. Hey, man, let's talk a little bit about the booze. Because, you know, during my time, I want to talk about whatever you're comfortable talking about. And anytime, you know, you don't want to say anything, just let me know.
I like it when you just call in the ring, Steve.
No, we're calling the ring, man. I mean, okay, so going up and down the road, guys do what they do. What drove you to the booze and the pills? Was it the loneliness? Was it because everybody else was doing it? What was it? Were you lonely?
Early on, I remember I was one of those guys who never really started drinking heavier till late 30s. And I was no angel before that. I just wasn't drinking and taking pills.
Right.
But it was suggested to me in that era, you know, we're talking early 80s, that a lot of the business was done in bars and stuff at that time.
Yes.
You know, you had to kind of get to know your opponent to have a somewhat of a relationship with them outside the ring so that you could produce a good product in the ring. And immature as it may sound, a lot of that was true. It was going on. At least the guys that I was hanging out with and the guys that I looked up to, a lot of that was going on. So I ventured down that path as well.
I've been, let me see, I've been away from the business now for a little over 10, 11 years. I really slowed down a lot of things I was doing. I've kind of admitted I was living pretty fast, and I would never classify myself as a drug addict or an alcoholic. That being said, I was the guy, you know, there's always kind of different cliques or whatever in the dressing room, whether it's drinkers, the pill guys, this guy, that guy. I was in the drinking crowd. What was your drink of choice? Was it beer? Was it whiskey, vodka?
Early on, I was more of a Coors Light out of a bottle guy with some Xannies. You know, Xanax are my drug of choice. I enjoy Xannies. I never was a pill guy. I mean, a pain pill guy. I never really enjoyed them. I used to, you know, take them to trade them with other guys for pain pills. I like the beer, occasional shot of Jack Daniels. You know, well, you know, more than one. But if I'm going to drink whiskey, it's Jack Daniels. And when I met Hogan, when we moved to WCW, I became a Miller Lite in a can guy, because I'll never forget Austin. You know, in his contract, bro, he had a rider where they had a garbage can full of Miller Lite in his locker room on ice. Big trash can. And cases in there. And so, one time we're in there talking to him, he goes, "Brother, you know, you've got a pretty big mitt." You know, so he takes the can as he's demonstrating. He goes, "You know what? You know, we shouldn't be doing it, but let's face it, we ride up and down the road with beer." He goes, "You got a big mitt, brother. You can cover the can. At least you got a champ. They don't sell soda in bottles anymore." You know, he was pointing out that should a law enforcement officer cruise by and see us all tipping things back in the car as we make towns, might be a better idea if it was a can. So I got to admit, that influenced me, and I switched to cans, Miller Lite cans since then.
Well, the cans are always easier to dispose of once you get a shit pile of them. Let's talk about you. But you were never a needle guy, though. Where you weren't using any needles?
Well, not intravenous, if that's what you mean. I mean, not in my veins, if that's what you mean. I'm not going to lie and say a few needles have never hit my buttocks.
Well, yeah. No, I'm talking about the street drugs and the prescription drugs.
No. All my stuff was roids from doctors.
Right. Hey, man, while we're talking about the health, you're on the upswing. Just the one other kind of a train wreck type moment was in 2011 at April 8th when you appeared for that promotion up there. Where was it? Massachusetts somewhere.
Fall River, Mass, I think it was.
Fall River, Mass. Dude.
Flew into Providence, apparently.
What happened? What was going on?
I remember right before that, I had a real problem with seizures for a long time. And I don't know, they don't know if it's that multiple concussion syndrome, which I think a lot of us had suffered from, you know, that brain injury that's becoming a real big deal in the NFL and probably maybe should be in wrestling. But anyway, some of that, you know, legitimate brain damage, whether it's lifestyle, you know, of the, you know, the booze and the drugs or the, you know, repeated concussions or whatever. I was having some, you know, brain deficit and some epileptic seizures pretty regularly. So I was on meds for those, but I had this trip coming up. I was going to go up there because, you know, Pete Polacco, PJ Walker, Just Incredible was working there, and I was going to go just to see my buddy. And I had had a seizure and fell in my home and injured my then hip, which was already shot again. And as I was preparing for the trips and getting my cardiac blood work done regularly, I'd limp into the hospital to see the doctor about my heart, and he would say, "Hey, do you need something for pain?" Well, you know, my little antenna would go, "Well, yeah, okay." And I took the pain pills, and I swore, "How about some somas, too?" And I had some bikes and some somas and some Xanax. And I'd been taking the Xanax, but I hadn't had any pain pills or any somas in quite a while. And my, you know, stupid thinking was, well, let me take that same dose that I took back when I was pounding the roads all the time. And, brother, when I got off that plane, I didn't know what country I was in. You know, I apologize to the people who came out to see me. I know they wanted to see me on my A game, and I wasn't on my A game then.
Well, what happened after the thing went down in the ring? You guys tried to shoot an angle, and did someone take your ass to the hospital, or how did you get back home?
Yeah, you know what happened is I come out of the ring, and you know, there's police officers there for security and stuff like that. It was actually a pretty decent little house. It was one of those tall, small, cool buildings up north. You know, a really cool venue. And I come back, you know, and I vaguely remember talking to a cop, which is not one of my favorite things, like seeing a cop. And the guy goes, "Scott, are you going to hurt yourself?" And I said, "No, man, I'm not going to hurt myself, bro." But I said something. At that point, Steve, I was so low. It's like, I said, "But I'm not scared to die." But I was talking to the guy philosophically and stuff, you know. But all of a sudden, he made this look, and I went, "Oh, man, I shouldn't have said that, should I?" And he went, "You know, now they're worried that I'm going to maybe hurt myself or hurt somebody, you know." So I had to go to the psych hospital in Providence, which for me, though, I mean, I don't mean to make light of it, but my life has been, I'm all for the psych care. I've been in lots of psych facilities, and I feel like I learned a few things along the way. Actually, I went there and wanted to stay longer, and they forced me out. You know, because I'm on, my insurance was from Florida, and I'm in a facility in Rhode Island, and they didn't accept it, and they didn't want me. So, I mean, yeah, it was just one more, like, "Hey, Scott, have you got a second? Can we speak to you? You know, you're out of control." It was a good thing. A lot of people came, you know, I mean, I don't want to say good thing, but a positive thing that happened from that experience was a lot of people got a hold of me and said, "All right, enough, you know, enough. Get your stuff together."
Scott, do you suffer from clinical depression?
I remember the first time I was asked that was by some shrink out in L.A. where you are. 15 years ago, maybe 20, some guy said, like, this high-dollar shrink, right? I'm trying to get all my eggs in a row, so I'm going to improve myself. And I go see the shrink, and he goes, "Are you depressed?" And I remember thinking, compared to what, bro?
Right.
Like, when bad things happen, I'm sad. When good things happen, I'm happy. What? What's your question? You know, like, I didn't like the meds. They made me feel kind of dull. So I just, I don't know. I have been diagnosed with that, but then as I deal with more experts in the field of mental health, I've found some other issues that they want me to address. I'm happy to report I'm doing good, man. I feel obnoxiously happy, like heat-seekingly happy lately.
Well, I'm glad that you're happy. And, you know, I was watching some of the stuff on YouTube. I watched when DDP reached out and called your ass, him and Jake, and got you or whatever. They invited you to come to Atlanta. I guess you were down in Florida, correct? And they gave you a call, and you're currently in Atlanta now. You're still living with DDP, or you moved out? How's the story?
In fact, Steve, when I was with my son, I'm helping Cody get set up in a place here. I have a son, Cody, who's 22, and my daughter, Cassie's 18. And she's still in Florida. It's in the University of Central Florida, not too far from where my home is and where her mother lives. And Cody and I decided to come here. I mean, I came here, then Dally invited him here. And, you know, he's a pro wrestler. He's had 10 matches so far. And there's a lot more going on for an indie scene wrestler here in Georgia than there is in Central Florida. So we're in a good situation here. But to your moving thing, we decided to get a place. Actually, setting Cody up in a place, because I'm probably going to end up back in Florida. But we're going to meet the landlord, in fact, as soon as we finish this interview. But we got the power turned on. It's all set. It's really sweet. I'm getting to watch him grow up and handle his business. And again, Steve, I just feel so lucky, man. I keep landing on my feet. I don't know why, but the things, I just keep getting breaks, and I'm just so grateful.
You know what? I want to talk about Cody in just a second, though. But when you say you're going to go back down to Florida, I know that's where you've been living for quite some time. You've been in Atlanta for a couple of months. If you go back to Florida, left your own devices with no support system, will you be cool? Will you be okay? Is it a smart move to return just yet?
Probably not, Steve. I'll never live there again. I'm going to go there because, like I mentioned, my daughter lives near there. And I'm going to go ahead. You know, I've got the problem right now. I mean, I don't want to sound like I got problems. I'm really blessed. But I have some property in Central Florida that's hard to sell. Nobody really wants it. I think I'm just going to go empty the house. And I don't know. I may look for a place here. I've got some friends in Miami that I'm that look real attractive to me. I'm looking at a situation maybe to live in Miami, spend a little time in Orlando and some time here in Atlanta and just kind of do something like that, you know. Yeah, I don't think being in that house would be that healthy for me. I've been told that for years, but I've lived there 20 years, and, you know, it was my ex-wife's dream house, so I like it. But, yeah, probably not a good idea, bro, because I got 20 acres in the woods on a private lake behind me with no neighbors, so it's easy for me to seclude myself, which I've learned through lots of therapy maybe isn't the best thing.
Sometimes, man, when you get out there and you can hear that 12-pack of beer calling, that bottle of vodka, sometimes, you know, you can really hear those voices, hey, you know, and then it just kind of leads you right back down to the same path you were talking. And speaking of talking, I'm talking to Scott Hall, Razor Ramon. You can follow Scott on Twitter at Scott Hall NWO. You can follow his young son, who we're fixing to talk about, Cody_Hall1. And you can also reach out to Scott for bookings and appearances for Scott and Cody. And here's the email address for that. It's Scott@razorforlife.com. That's number four, not written for. Scott@razorforlife.com. Let's talk about Cody. Who all is helping to train this young man? And how old is he? 21, 22, you said?
He turned 22 at the end of May. So
he's a big drink of water. How tall is he?
Gosh, I'll tell you what, bro. He's 6'8 and growing.
Does he have your athleticism?
I think his mother is a real good athlete as well. You know, I just want to say, like, not a lot of great things came from that union, but we have two wonderful kids, and, yeah, Cody can move. I couldn't be prouder, Steve.
Well, we're talking to Scott Hall, and we just got on the subject of young Cody, his son, as he plows his way forward into a future in the squared circle. I'm going to take a break right now. I'm going to come right back, talk with Razor. We're going to talk about his run in the WWF, the Click, all his running mates, how he was responsible by a large part of making my career very successful due to an incident which happened in Madison Square Garden. I'm coming back with the one and only Scott Hall. Hey, man, do you own or rent your home? Sure you do, and I bet it can be hard work. You know what's easy? Bundling policies with GEICO. GEICO makes it easy to bundle your homeowner's or renter's insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing, too, because you already have so much to do around your home. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. It's GEICO easy. Visit GEICO.com today. That's GEICO.com.
Today we're welcoming back IP Vanish to the show. So what is IP Vanish? IP Vanish is a virtual private network, a VPN for short. And a VPN is a super important tool that helps you safely browse the internet. You can use a VPN on your computers, tablets, phones, even things like your Fire Stick when you're streaming media. When you use a VPN, all your data is encrypted. What you're reading, what you're searching, what you're watching, whatever it is you're doing. That's important because what you're doing on the internet isn't my business, and it's no one else's business either. IPVanish helps you remain anonymous and secure on the internet. IPVanish is just $3.49 a month. For just $3.49 a month, or $27.99 a year, you can help protect your online privacy and security. Now, here's everything you need to know. Anonymous IP addresses. This means your personal IP address can't be tracked by anyone on the web. You can circumvent any online censorship. IPVanish has more than 1,500 servers in 70-plus locations. Get protection when using public Wi-Fi. Remember, with IPVanish, all your data is encrypted so no one can snoop on what you're doing. 24/7 support. Email them, chat with them, even call them. They're there to help. If you remember, these guys supported the show a few weeks ago. They've come back with an even better deal, wanting to offer something special for the new year. You're getting 65% off now. So go to ipvanish.com/Austin to claim your 65% savings. They have plans starting at $3.49 a month or $27.99 a year. This is the time to sign up. With our discount and their current promotion, you can get a VPN for 65% off their usual offering. IPVanish is the best of the best, even rated 4.7 out of 5 on Trustpilot, and that's with more than 6,000 reviews. Show these guys some love. They're repeat sponsors. Remember, it's ipvanish.com/Austin to get the deal and start protecting yourself online.
Welcome to the Steve Austin Show.
Calling it in the ring. Lock up, kid. Grab a headlock. One tackle, drop down, reverse a hip toss. Get it again. Scott, we're talking. I told you we were going to call us in the ring.
All right.
Before we went to break, we started talking about young Cody, 22 years old. Who all's chipping in on his training and how much further? He's got 10 matches under his belt, right?
Well, yeah, Steve. And the first six were in. You know, one of the things where it was once every 2-3 months down there in Central Florida, there's just nothing going on. Since he's been in Atlanta the last 7, almost 8 weeks, he's had 3. He's got 2 this weekend. He's got 1 Friday, 1 Saturday. So, and these aren't real huge money-making things, but at this point, he just needs to be in the ring. And speaking of that, I mean, Lex Luger, who I've known forever and is a neighbor here, he's moments down the street from here, you know, where I'm staying now and where we'll be moving. The place that Cody and I are moving to, Steve, is literally walking distance from Dally's crib. So I'll still have that support and still have some space. I think it'll make it cooler for everybody.
Good.
A lot of personalities under one roof here. But, yeah, it's just, I don't know what to say, man. I feel so overwhelmed with good things right now.
Well, you seem like a cat who needs your space, and I would imagine everybody in that house does. I know me, I'm kind of a loner that's my nature, so I can understand that. When we're talking real quickly to finish up with Cody, who's doing the in-ring training with this young cat? What's his style? Is he working like a big man? Because here's the thing, Scott, when I was watching a lot of tape of you before we talked, and I've followed your whole career, you're a big dude, man, at 6'7", sometimes, you know, upwards of 300, and just jacked. But you never truly worked like a big guy who wouldn't take bumps for anybody. You sold appropriately for everybody, but you didn't work the classic big man style, which you could have. And maybe that speaks to your athleticism or work ethic or the, you know, wanting to be able to tell a more rounded story. So, you know, what is Cody's work style?
Well, he is a big guy, but, and so I want him working strong, stuff that makes sense. He studies a lot of, right now, you know, he studies a lot of Barry Windham. He's one of Terry Gordy, some Dick Murdoch, Sid. You know, he likes to watch what the big guys do, you know, how they move and you know, their presence in the ring. He's really athletic, and back to your initial question that I kind of slipped my mind was who's helping him. I have the pleasure of being in the ring with him a lot, but it's really weird for me, Steve, because I'm dad. You know, I'm always going to be dad. Like, I'm not razor to him. I'm dad, you know? So it's like, yeah, my dad. So it's really great. There's guys in the gym that he works out. This one young kid, Dylan, who's an intern here for Dally at the house. He's a wrestler. He works out with him every morning. And then, you know, he's got Jake here, of course, you know, Jake the Snake Roberts to, you know, watch his matches with him. Like, when we come back from a show, you know, it's already on YouTube. The advantages the kids have today, Steve, we didn't have these when we were coming up. They can have a match. Cody can come back from the ring, and I've got the match on my phone to show him.
Yeah.
So while the juices are flowing, you know how it is. Well, you still got that sight. You can see what you did, what worked, what didn't work, so you can, you know, edit your style to get it really tight. His style, yeah, he's working big man, but like wrestling big man. You know what I mean? A little Japanese influence, some of that European stuff. He watches a lot of that. And Cody has a background as an amateur wrestler in high school.
Oh, tremendous. Yeah.
So, yeah, he's, I think, Steve, I'm trying to get him to not be so focused on telling a story by being a heel or a babyface. Just be you. Just be Cody Hall.
Yeah.
Do your stuff. Let the other guy do his stuff. You know what I mean? That more of a prize fight mentality about doesn't matter who's heel, who's baby. Just let the people fill the building and cheer for who they want to.
Yeah, and that will come, you know, really at a later date, man. As long as you're putting together the solid mechanics, you know, those layers of psychology, you know, that's gonna take a couple of years. But man, right off the top of the bat, when you mentioned Barry Windham, Bam Bam, and God dang, Captain Redneck,
Murdoch.
Man, you couldn't have named three better cats to model a career off of. So it sounds like he's going down the right path. And to any of the young cats, I always talk to my young fans that are trying to get into the business, and I'll give this advice to young Cody Hall, and you can follow him at Cody_Hall1. Watch as many matches as you can. Obviously, with the brain trust that you guys have down there between Jake and yourself, because you've always had a tremendous mind for the business. And I know Dallas has too, but he's got so much of his information from yourself and Jake. But then all of a sudden, you know, by the same token, has formed his own opinions. He's got a great brain trust to pick from. But to Cody, I say, watch as many matches as you can and go back 10 and 20, 30 years to watch the tried and true pure workers, watch the stories that those guys were telling. I'm not running down today's product. You need to stay in touch with everything that's going on, but watch as many matches as you can. Watch them over and over and over again. And then start breaking down why they did what they did, when, and put it all together. But hell, let's go back to the man, Scott Hall himself, because we've been jumping all over the place, and that's what we said we were going to do. Scott, when you broke in, and your Wikipedia here, it says you were trained by Hiro Matsuda, Al Snow, Barry Windham, Mike Rotunda, and Chris Adams. Is that true?
I don't remember ever having any encounters with Chris Adams, and I'm not too sure I crossed paths with Al Snow until I was already in the business.
So who trained you? Let's break it down. Scott, who trained you to be a professional wrestler?
I was working out with Hiro Matsuda when I ran into Barry Windham in a Publix grocery store. And Hiro was beating me up, man. He was getting me really tired doing a lot of calisthenics. You know, Hindu squats by the thousands and push-ups and ab stuff. And then he'd get you real tired, then he'd stretch you, you know. So that was okay. He wasn't charging me. We did it at his little dojo and across the street with a gas station. And all Hiro wanted from me, he didn't even want it from me. I was bringing it to him because I was learning how the business worked. After every workout, I would thank him. I'd walk across the street, buy him a six-pack of light beer, bring it over, give it to him, tell him I'll see you tomorrow. So he was really good to me, and I was doing that. I was staying in Tampa, and I ran into Barry in a grocery store. Now, I've been going to shows. I'm a huge fan of Barry Windham. There he is standing right next to me. And we're both eyeballing kind of the same cut of steak. And, you know, so I said, hey, how you doing? I'm a big fan. He goes, hey, how are you, man? He goes, you know, what do you do? You know, because in Tampa at that time, you know, you had the USL, Tampa Bay Bandits. You had, obviously, the Buccaneers, you know, and pro wrestlers there. So there's lots of big dudes in Tampa in that era. So it wasn't uncommon to see muscled up guys walking around. And so he goes, what are you doing? I said, well, actually, I'm trying to get in your business. You know, I'm working out with Hiro Matsuda. And he said, F Hiro Matsuda. He said, he'll just have you doing Hindu squats all day. He said, meet me at the Sportatorium tomorrow at 12 noon. Now, this is the Tampa Sportatorium, not that famous one in Dallas. And it's 106 North Albany. It was where, you know, where they shut filmed the TV, and it's where the office was. Of course, I didn't know any of this at that time. And I go down there. Now, Barry Windham says 12 o'clock. I know he's got a wrestle in Miami that night. No way Barry Windham's going to show up at 12 o'clock. So I get there at 11 o'clock just in case.
Yeah.
He comes rolling in at noon, and he brings Mike Rotunda with him. These two guys spend 2 hours with me, Steve. I've never stepped in a ring before. I'm a legitimate risk to end your career by just laying my hands on you, brother. I'm about 290. I mean, a crowbar. I will hurt you. They took bumps for me, and then they bumped each other, and Barry would say, okay, like Mike, slam me. He'd go, Scott, watch. Then he'd go, okay, I'm going to slam Mike, watch. And then he'd go, you slam Mike, I'm going to watch. Then slam me, Mike's going to watch. The first bump I ever took in a wrestling ring, Steve, I laid flat in that ring in the Tampa Sportatorium. Barry grabbed me around the shoulders. Mike grabbed me around the ankles. They lifted me up waist high and dropped me just so I could feel what a bump felt like. And that was my first experience ever in a wrestling ring. I still remember today.
Man, that speaks to, I mean, God dang, to Barry Windham and Mike Rotunda to go out of their way for no reason other than the fact that they wanted to help this young cat out. I remember when I got into WCW. And Barry came up to me and said, kid, who you traveling with? And I didn't really have a ride. I was a new guy in town, and I was riding down the road with him and Pee-wee. And, you know, Barry would always rent those Cadillacs. And so he said, kid, you want to drive? And I said, well, sure. I'd never driven a Cadillac before in my life. I'd never sat in one. So there I am driving down the road, looking at all the controls. And, of course, Barry's riding shotgun because he didn't really give two shits about driving, reading a Hot Rod magazine. Pee-wee was in the back. I almost run off the road because I'm looking at all the controls, and I jerk it back. And, you know, Barry was always so cool. You know, he wouldn't sell anything unless he's in a ring. But so, you know, he just looked up at his magazine and said, you okay, kid? I said, yeah. We kept going down the road. But I was a huge fan of Barry Windham. His work there for several years was just unparalleled.
Yeah, and so effortless, Steve. What a lot of people don't realize, I'm going to throw this out to you. Watch the way Barry Windham gets into a wrestling ring. He goes from the floor through the second rope in one stride, and it looks so smooth that you can't tell how freakingly athletic it is. He's like a 6'8", 290-pound, like, gazelle.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that guy was so damn graceful, and some of the stuff that he did in the ring, which begs the question I was going to ask you, who really influenced your in-ring style? Because when I watch you, man, I mean, dude, you're a big guy. I remember when I first saw you, I guess you might have broke in somewhere else, but I caught you on AWA as Big Scott Hall working the cowboy gimmick. But your in-ring stuff was just athletic, smooth. Who did you pattern or model your in-ring style after?
I don't know. I was just, you know, I was influenced a lot. I'm an Army brat, so I traveled all over the United States, and then I went to high school in Munich, Germany, and so I never really got that hometown feeling for any one place. I mean, Orlando's the longest I've lived in one place, but I, you know, when my parents got divorced when I was in high school, so we moved back to the States, and then I decided I couldn't take the drama at home, and I came to Florida with some of my buddies. So I started watching that Florida Championship Wrestling when, you know, Dusty was booking, and he was the king, and, you know, Barry was like the prince of Florida, and, you know, you had people, Kevin Sullivan and all his henchmen, and it was really a good time to me. It came on Saturday evenings, you know, and, you know, they wrestled in the Sportatorium and I mean, the Eddie Graham Sports Complex in Orlando every Sunday, and I used to go out there, and I remember thinking, I was attracted to pro wrestling because I loved the lifestyle, you know. I mean, I didn't know the huge money would be involved, I mean, and it'd be worldwide and everything, and I'm all glad it was, don't get me wrong, but I just wanted to be over in Orlando.
Right.
So I could get dates. I just wanted to be able to get a date, you know what I mean? Yeah. So I thought, hey, that TV doesn't hurt. You know, and people think you're a big deal. So I just was enchanted by the Florida Championship Wrestling style. I would consider myself a Southern babyface, although I worked a lot as a heel. I like the Southern babyface. Got to be able to throw a good punch. Got to be able to talk some smack, sell, and come back.
Well, yeah, when
you sell, you make a comeback, then you talk about it. And I just love that style. But my first real break was with New Japan Pro Wrestling. And when I went there, you know, I went with Masa Saito right after his first trip back after the big prison thing when him and Tim Patera got in trouble at McDonald's in Wisconsin. I went back from then and didn't realize what a big shove I was getting. I was his partner. And then they put me with Dick Murdoch and Sakaguchi, who was like the big boss there with Antonio Inoki. They came to me and said, you watch Murdoch. We want you to do same thing. You know, Japanese same thing. So they told me change my ring gear from that cowboy stuff. They wanted me in black boots and black tights and black knee pads. They wanted me to dress and wrestle like Murdoch. So I did. And, you know, I would say Murdoch was a big influence on me. And one time I'd be in matches with Murdoch. And you got to remember now, I don't know how crazy Dick felt about being with me. It was a big, big thrill for me. I don't know how he felt about it. And Murdoch's the kind of guy, brother, he's such a character. I mean, I'm sitting in the locker room. I'm nervous. Like, we're in the finals of the tag tournament or something. You know what I mean? In Tokyo.
It's like
Tokyo.
A shoot. Yeah.
And Murdoch is dipping tobacco, playing cards up until his music's playing.
Oh,
and I'm
Jesus.
Going, like, I want to talk things over, bro. You know what I mean? You know, I want to talk who's starting, who's what. I'll never forget one time. I'm like, standing there with him. The one time I was in a six-man tournament where I was teamed with Bob Orton Jr. and Dick. So I go out there. I haven't talked to either one of them. We get in a ring. Everybody gets introduced. I turn around. They're both standing on the apron. I went, you want me to start? You know? And Murdoch, man, I would wrestle and I would do stuff. And Murdoch would go, no, take it down. Take him down. Take his arm. Work his arm. Tag me, tag me. And then I tag him in, and he would go like this, boom, 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 take the guy down. He'd go, now you do it. He tagged me in. We did that back and forth a few times, just like the shoot.
God.
And the fans started to get with the story.
Right.
Like Murdoch schooling me.
Yeah.
Schooling me.
That's awesome.
And it was great. I just had the pleasure of being around some really talented guys, and I guess it rubbed off.
Hey, man, when you mentioned Bob Orton Jr., that's one of my favorite workers of all time.
No, me too. I'm a huge mark for Orton.
The stuff that guy did in the ring, you know, I was watching some matches before we started talking. I was looking at your working punch. You always had a badass working punch, as did Dick Murdoch. How did you learn that damn thing? You're a big, jacked up dude. Did the working punch come natural to you, or was it a work in progress?
You know, Steve, I before I got into wrestling, I'm one of them guys. I never had a real job, man. I worked in strip clubs as a bouncer, then bartender, and then I've been blessed enough to be a wrestler all these years. I never had a real job. I'm not a very educated guy. But on the days back then, I was really into lifting heavy. So I was lifting about 4 days a week. On the days that I didn't lift, I would hit the speed bag and the heavy bag. I had them in my garage there at my place, you know, where I was renting with my buddies in Orlando. And so we would have three stations. We'd hit the heavy bag, the speed bag, and we'd jump rope. We did stuff like that. So my hands were always kind of trained. But with the working punch, I can remember I crossed paths with Shawn Michaels in Kansas City, Central States Championship Wrestling, which was brutal. Bob Geigel and Bulldog Bob Brown, it was horrifying. But we got to be in the ring 6 nights a week. And Shawn Michaels and I were hanging together, traveling together, and always throwing working punches at everybody, at everything, against the wall, at everybody. And you know how it is. If you just throw enough punches, I've created a monster now. Cody, who's like standing, he's in the, we're here at Dallas's house, and we share a bathroom. We have like the Jack and Jill bathroom, and I can see him over in his room. And he's walking around. Every time now, he's just walking around punching stuff, throwing elbows at you. Just, it's like, got to be on guard at all moments. But I guess that's how I did it, Steve, just repetition.
Hey, I was watching some of your matches. Again, I've been doing my damn research on this. I started watching when you transitioned into Razor Ramon, and you were flipping a damn toothpick out of your mouth at Tony Chimmel. And you always say something happened to the gold, Chico. Something going to happen to you.
Right.
How often did you almost put Tony Chimmel's eye out because you seemed to really take a pleasure in flicking that toothpick?
Well, yeah, Steve, you know how slick Vince is TV, and I know you do know. I'll never forget the first time I did that at a TV. I didn't know. I had never been around a TV that was that sophisticated. Like, I remember talking to somebody, Kevin Dunn maybe, or somebody under him going, hey, listen, I only got so many minutes allotted for my match. Should I walk to the ring faster? And he went, no, you walk how you walk, and we'll get you to the ring when we need you there. You know, because everything was edited at that time.
Right.
There was no Raw yet. And about just, like, the first time I leaned over to give the guy my gimmick, I thought, well, here's my gold. I'm concerned about my ring wear.
Right.
Make sure it makes it back. And I was just pantomiming to Schimmel. And later, a guy, you know how slick their TV is? The guy pulled me aside and said, Scott, we couldn't hear you.
Mm.
And I said, well, that's because I wasn't really saying anything. He said, no, say it. We want you to say it. I remember, Steve, being in the ring before, back in the squash match era, when I was getting the big razor push at the heel, and being in there with, you know, a job guy, a guy who's, you know, less experienced. And something would go wrong in the match. Often, I might blow the match. I would blow the high spot, and I would look at the, you know, I didn't know what to do. I was just going to continue like we do. Something went wrong. It didn't look good, but we just kept going. The cameraman went, hey, Razor. Hey, Razor. And I went, what? I looked over. Here's the camera guy on the floor. And he goes, back him into the same rope and do it again.
Oh, geez.
So I grabbed that poor kid. I slapped him in the face, looked right at the hard camera and went, take two. And then did it again. And a lot of times they would edit stuff out of guys' masks when it would go wrong. My take two thing became kind of part of my.
Remember,
they started leaving it in. I would slap the poor guy even when it was my fault. You know, but that's how slick that TV is. They can get anything off.
But, you know, going to, and that's tremendous because I remember the Take-Two stuff, and I remember hearing the legend of it. And that was when you weren't working live, you know, obviously.
Yeah.
But, right. You know, going back to when you said you were walking to the ring and, hey, I only have so many minutes. Should I walk to the ring faster? You know, and that's you thinking about, hey, I need to get my shit in the ring to get over, when so many of your mannerisms outside the ring and that persona and that character and that personality was what got Razor over. So it's those things that sometimes you want to, hey, leave out or hurry up on are the real salt and pepper on a good steak. And that's what I think a lot of these young cats are missing out on.
Yeah, Steve, I have heard that. You know, the WWE, I don't know if you've been there, but apparently right moments from minutes from where my home is in Juliota, Florida, is the new WWE, like, performance center. And I hear it's the bomb. But like you're talking, I feel real comfortable with what Cody's doing now and what, you know, we're doing with his wrestling career, because we're going to make towns. You know what I mean? We're going to towns. He's wrestling in front of different audiences and stuff. And I just think that it's a perfect environment for that, like to learn your craft, as opposed to maybe being in a warehouse with a bunch of the same dudes over and over. Not knocking what they're doing, I'm sure it's the best, and I know they pay those guys. But, and for me too, it's a chance to get closer to my son again, because there was a period when things weren't that great for us. You know, I had some drama in my family because of my lifestyle and what was going on, and, you know, divorced from their mother, so it's really a chance for me to get to know my kids again. You know, my son Cody and my daughter Cassidy are cool enough to give me, you know, a 100th chance to be back in their lives. And, you know, I'm just exploring that to the fullest.
You know, and about that, you know, obviously, you know, WWE, it's a smart thing because, you know, back in the days when you and I were a kid, everybody wanted to be a pro wrestler. I mean, I grew up watching this stuff, and I just, you know, when I went to my first pro wrestling camp school, I just thought, you know, everybody was going to show up. There's going to be jacked up, and there's going to be like 200 people in line. You know, when I went, I was the only one in shape, and there was about 30 of us, and everybody looked pretty, you know, like normal people. So to make the point that I was going to make, you know, WWE is doing what they've got to do. There's not that feeder system anymore, so they're making that factory so they can, you know, handpick all these great athletes from, you know, whether it's, you know, the people who can't make it in football, baseball, or, you know, these high-level college programs, and give them a character. And that's one way to do it. But, yeah, down that grassroots road, paying your dues, making the towns, talking to the veterans. And the veteran in this case is you, the father. But no, young Cody is in great hands. You cannot substitute, because I know you and I were talking. I know Cody talks to a lot of these promoters on the phone. He's learning the business. He's learning how to, you know, make decisions, learn his worth, you know, see what these guys are willing to pay, and learn that aspect of the business. And you can't replace what Cody's doing right now.
No, you're right, Steve. I mean, I feel so excited about it, man. I've learned a little lessons about myself lately, and I found that as soon as I quit trying to fix everything myself and I let other people help me, because so many people have been wanting to help me and have offered to help me, that I put my pride down. I had a real problem with letting people help me for most of my life, because I thought it meant I was weak and I was lacking something. But it really meant, no, they're just kind and they want to help because, in fact, they like me. So I've been doing that better, and now that I'm just loosened up and letting people help, man, things are flowing.
Hey, I didn't mean to cut you off, but speaking about help, yeah. I know that when we talked on the phone earlier, you wanted to say a few words about, you know, your surgery. When you did the hip surgery with Dallas, you guys reached out and created this fund, and you wanted to reach out and say thank you for that.
Yeah, if you'll give me a moment here, Steve, I just want to thank all the sponsors of the Bionic Bad Guy. I know that times are hard now, and that money does not come easy. And I appreciate everybody who donated. I appreciate your kindness and your generosity. And at the same time, I think apparently a thing was set up for me. I'm finding more out about it now than I did when it was taking place. But, you know, we offered photo, you know, 8x10s to the fans, phone calls to the fans. I made all the phone calls. I signed all the 8x10s. Now I'm trying to figure out this Skype thing, and that's coming next. I mean, you know, I've got people who are getting Skypes, and the T-shirts have been ordered. We've got T-shirts going out to people, and I just want to thank everybody for the generosity, and I want them to know that I think they made a good investment and that everything is all good.
I tell you what, you've made a lot of fans over the years. It's been a hell of a ride for you, a great career. We're going to keep talking. I'm going to talk about to Scott, whether he liked working heel or baby the most. We're going to talk about that Madison Square Garden incident, which helped me cement my path in the world of professional wrestling. We're coming back with Scott Hall. You can follow him on Twitter, Scott Hall NWO. Coming right back after a word from our sponsors.
This is Denny Somach, host of The Rock Podcast. I'm a producer, author, and rock historian, and I want to share with you some of the greatest stories in rock and roll.
Well, Bonzo was the best hard rock drummer ever, hands down. I mean, no one comes within a mile of him.
I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. John Lennon had this wise guy look on his face, just like me and my friends were just a bunch of wise guys, street kids.
The first guitar I ever had was Spanish guitar, and I couldn't really get the hang of it. I was only 13.
I had never written a song before, actually, and so Jim says, okay, everybody go home and write some songs, you know. And so I went home and wrote Light My Fire.
Join me for The Rock Podcast, the only podcast that matters, from Podcast One or wherever you get yours.
Welcome to the Steve Austin Show.
Yeah, that's right. I'm talking to Scott Hall, the one and only Razor Ramon. And coming back, we've been having some great conversation. I told Scott we're just going to call this thing in the ring, and that's what we're going to continue to do. And one of Scott's nicknames as Razor Ramon was the bad guy. Scott, did being called the bad guy, did you prefer working heel or baby?
Steve, I got to say, I preferred working heel. I just think that in any kind of a, you know, if you look at a TV show or movie or any kind of entertainment thing, you know, nothing happens until the heel enters the scene. You know, I always felt like as a baby, you know, like for me as a baby face when I was in the ring, you know, you kind of just have to stand there in your crouch because you can't really do anything until the heel does something.
Right.
You know, if he wants to walk around, mess with the crowd, do anything, you just kind of stand there. I think I like being the heel because in the era when I came up, you know, the heel's called the match. Like
right.
The heel led the match. I don't think that's still the case anymore. I think everything's talked over in the back and it's all choreographed. But back in my era, the heel called it and the babyface just kind of was quiet. So I liked that part, kind of being in charge.
You know, being in charge is one thing, but also I felt as a heel, and of course I had my greatest success as a babyface, an edgy babyface, but as a heel, you know, you can do no wrong. You can run across the ring and trip and fall down. You can have egg on your face. You can, you know, you can do anything. As a babyface, you don't have that luxury.
Very true. Very true. I mean, I was really lucky. You know, I started as a heel with that Razor gimmick, and, you know, Vince gave me a good push, and it was, you know, I was introduced with a series of vignettes coming soon and that kind of thing. And you know how it is, Steve, when you hit some of these bigger markets in, you know, in the United States or even, you know, even in Europe and stuff where the fans are a little more sophisticated, sometimes they're drawn to that villain character. So, you know, after several years as the heel, the Razor character, the fans were starting to turn me baby. You know, they'd be chanting
right.
Razor sometimes if I was against a less popular baby face. And that's hard to be that baby face in that situation. And so Vince had noticed that, and he pitched the idea to me that, you know, he wanted to turn me baby face, but he didn't want it to be the same old thing. He didn't want somebody running in to save me or any of that. And that's what we did the whole angle with the 1-2-3 Kid, where, you know, he beat Razor. And
right.
Vince laid that out to me, Steve, 6 months in advance. And we did it exactly as he laid it out with, you know, with the rematch, and then the Kid took the 10 grand. And all the other heels would make fun of me on their interviews and ultimately work with DiBiase at SummerSlam, be with Mike Vince.
That's
how Vince did business at that time. I don't know what they do up there now because I haven't been there, but, you know, it was really cool to have it all laid out in front of me months and months in advance and know where my career was headed. You know, it was, that's how they turned me baby. I never really had to change anything I did or anything I said or any of my style. It's just that the fans' reaction to me was different. It was like, well, we don't really like you, Razor, but you don't have to take that for DiBiase. And so, you know, DiBiase was a well-established heel at that time.
Right.
So it's just, it was a great situation for me.
Wasn't that fun, though, back in the day? I came around when they were still using that big calendar, and they would flip pages, and everything was written in pencil because him and Pat had set it, the swimming pool, and it booked the territory, and you could look way down the road at, you know, your path, where you were going. And, you know, if something happened along the way, if someone got hurt, you know, you'd erase something, you'd put something else in there. But it was real nice to kind of get that layout of your course. Now, how did you pitched the idea of Razor Ramon to Vince, or did he pitch it to you? How was that born?
Well, I mimicked Razor, and even prior to that, the Diamond Stud, when I rarely spoke to him, but when I did, I would say, I'm the bad guy or something. I was a huge, you know, Scarface mark. I'm a huge fan of that movie and Al Pacino's character as Tony Montana.
Yeah.
So I was mimicking that. And at that time, you know, the character in the movie was a guy who was real hungry and willing to do just about anything to be successful in what he wanted and to get things that he wanted for the people he cared about. And at that time in my life, that was a shoot for me too, man. You know, I had bounced around 4 or 5 years in the wrestling business internationally, not much success in the U.S., successful in like Puerto Rico, Europe, and Japan, not much in the U.S. where it really mattered, and was about to give up when, I ended up coming back from Europe with, you know, I was married to Cody's mother then, and Cody was on the way. He was in her belly about 6 months along, and I needed a JOB. I was considering just giving up wrestling and, you know, working at Sears or something, maybe learn how to work a forklift, you know, have a name tag on my shirt.
Wow.
I didn't care. I'd get me a little duplex and have some kids and have the other riches in life. And again, like I said earlier, when I quit worrying about everything, it started happening.
Right.
Excuse me. I resigned myself to the fact that wrestling wasn't going to be my deal. I was going to go ahead and try to have a family and do that. I had one more commitment to make in Europe, and I went. And when I came back, here comes Cody on the way, and I need a JOB. I called Dallas and I pitched the Diamond Stud to him. That worked. I appeared on WCW TV one time. Now, Steve, I've been calling Vince's office every week for a year.
Are you kidding me?
Asking to speak to Pat, because Hennig told me to do it, so right. I do it. I call, and believe me, I feel like a jabron, and I wasn't jabron. And they call, can I speak to Pat? He's busy. Can I leave take a message? Tell him Scott Hall called. So I do it every time for a year. Now I appear on the WCW TV one time with this new look with the black hair and a stubble and a toothpick. And I get home. I have to drive from Atlanta back to Orlando. They don't even fly me. It's how valuable I am to the company. I drive back. It's 8 hours. I get home. There's two messages on my machine for Pat Patterson. So I call Pat. Immediately, I get put through this time. Wow. Mm. With the big shot. And hey, kid, this and that. You know, hey, Vince loves the new look. Well, tell me. You just signed a contract with those SOBs. And I said, Pat, I just got done signing one. I said, I don't want to work for them. I said, I wouldn't have called your office every week for a year if I did.
Right.
And he went, and he started laughing. I love that. He started laughing. He goes, calm down, kid, calm down. Goes, don't worry. In a year, you'll be able to tell him New York wants you. So a year later, I went up to New York. And again, I still had to try out. You know, I had a successful tryout match, Lexington, Kentucky. First match of the, you know, extended hours-long TV taping. I went out there, and they gave me a job guide to beat, because a lot of times when they brought guys in who had been in the business a little while at that time, Vince would check your attitude by taking a guy who'd been around and then having you do a job.
Right.
Just to see where your head's at.
Yeah.
When they give you that big push, they want to know you'll do business. And I had the match, and Vince, you know, at that time was really into the realism angle, like, you know, Big Boss Man was really a corrections officer. So he goes, well, I understand your father's in the service. I said, Vince, man, you want me to be G.I. Joe? I'll be the best G.I. Joe I could be. I said, did you ever see Scarface? He went, oh, no. And then, you know, I pitched the Razor gimmick to him, the Razor name, and, you know, he went with it, and the rest is history.
Well, tell me the story about how you pitched it, because you went into you already had the character down, right? You told him what he needed and what he didn't.
I've been doing it. I never, you know.
Well, break it down for me. How'd that go?
I've been doing it in the locker room.
So you say, hey, man, you give me the impression. Give me the Razor.
Oh, well, now I had the luxury of walking in there with Mr. Perfect, Kurt Hennig, who was like my mentor in this industry and who I knew from the AWA days. And Kurt was one of those guys who always cared about doing what was right for the business. You know, he babied me. He carried me. We were tag champions in Minneapolis. Yeah. Kurt did everything. All I did was make the comeback and beat the guy. And to the point where it made Kurt look weak to some of the fans, where unknowledgeable fans would say, "Yeah, Scott, you should dump in if he's holding you down." I'm going, "Hold me down, man. He's keeping me from drowning. I'm circling the toilet, man. This cat's the only one teaching me anything about what's really going on."
Yeah.
And so I go in to meet with Vince, and I go prepared because I've been around. You know, I got a new look, but I've still been in the business 5 years at this point. And I go in there prepared, but, you know, Kurt has schooled me to be humble.
Yep.
You know, so I go in there, and thanks for the opportunity, Mr. McMahon, and this and that, and I'll be ready. I'll be G.I. Joe if you want. I said, "You ever see Scarface?" He went, "No." And I said, "Say hello to the bad guy." So I just started doing the stick, you know, and yeah. He goes, "Wow," he laughed. He goes, "Well, we need a name." I said, and I've been thinking about it, like Shrug Shadow. You know, it's a different era. You had to have like a gimmicky, marketable
yeah,
name.
Yeah, 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 big, bigger than life.
Yeah, I was thinking Shrug Shadow. I remember Road Warrior Hawk gave me Deadbolt. But I was leaning towards Razor, so I pitched Razor, and Vince went, "Well, there's already Razor Ruddock, like the boxer." I said, "Yeah. I kick his monkey up, and, you know," I said, "it's just a line right out of Scarface." And yeah. Boom, you know, and he started laughing. He goes, "We need a last name." So I leave, you know, we leave there on a positive note, and I'm out there, you know, they erased my name off the board. I was just going to have matches on, like, their USA primetime show, just like Jabroni matches to fill time.
Yeah.
It took me off the board, you know, I'm going to get a push. I'm in the bathroom. I'm so happy. I'm washing my hands. Tito's like brushing his hair. Tito Santana. I said, "Tito, I need a last name starts with an R." He went, "Ramon." I went back to Vince's office, knocked on the door. I said, "Razor Ramon." He went, "That's it." And man, he left. You know, Steve, I was so flattered. We were doing it. I used to just tag along to TVs because Vince just wanted me seeing how things work, and I wasn't debuting yet.
Right.
And we were in Ottawa, Canada, at a TV, and Vince went, "Let's go." And we flew to South Beach with the Outlaw film crew and shot 4 or 5 vignettes the same day. You know, and I had brought wardrobe changes just in case.
Right.
It's okay. So it looked like it was different weeks. We shot about 5 of them in one day. Now, this is the funny part. You know how Vince is. He doesn't care. We're out there shooting. We're shooting. We don't have permits or anything. We're just outlaw, like, you know, commando style, setting up stuff, shooting, and then moving on. It starts to rain. You know how that tropical weather
is? Yeah, yeah.
It just starts to rain sideways. So we just break it. He's on the phone. His ticket's waiting for us. We go into Miami International Airport. Now, I've got a vest on with gold chains, no shirt, slick back hair with the curly cue, silk pants, you know, loafers. And in that airport, no one even looks twice. You know, and I'm jacked. But I'm with Vince, and everybody knows who Vince is. So
right.
They figure I must be somebody, but they don't know who yet. And it was just an experience I'll never forget. I felt like I was in costume walking through the airport. And in that airport, no one even looked twice.
You know, and when you tell that story, it reminds me of a couple of vignettes we did, you know, for me as I was stone cold and kind of laying the groundwork. But my point is about Vince. How much do you treasure those moments going back in the day when you think about those outlaw film crews going to get this footage to get this character over? And sure, you know, you're doing it to draw money, but Vince cares deeply, and he will go to the last corner of the world to help get a sumbitch over if he think he can. I mean, didn't you enjoy that about the guy? I mean, because that dude's got guts.
I'm a huge Vince guy. I'm a huge fan of Vince McMahon, and the way he's impacted our industry will never be matched.
No.
And I'll never forget, Steve, one thing I learned from Vince. I'm doing my very first vignette, and Vince is encouraging me to talk really slow.
Wow.
He wants me to pause and talk slowly. Yeah. He teaches me the difference between commanding people's attention and demanding it.
Right.
Like, you can commanding, it's almost a baby face thing, and there's a positive connotation. Where demanding, it's like being a little bit of a frisbee, you know,
right.
And that's where he wanted me to go with it. My very first time in Madison Square Garden, Steve, which is a really special building to me.
Oh, yeah.
You know how it is, the garden, man. I felt like I've made it now. I'm wrestling in Madison Square Garden. Not only that, I'm wrestling Randy Savage, and I'm going over. Are you kidding me? Somebody don't wake me up until after the match. This is a sweet dream. And you know, I go to the ring. I'm going out first, of course. It's with Mach. I'm going out first. And Vince, I was supposed to say a little something on a stick, and then they bring a match out. As I'm standing there, you know how there's a point in your ring music where you know to hit the curtain?
Yeah.
Okay, now I go. So I'm waiting, and Vince is standing there with me, right behind the curtain in the garden.
Yeah,
and
he goes, short entrance.
And he goes, and he, yeah, the short entrance one. You know how it was.
Yeah.
He would stand back, and he'd step through to watch the match. So I'm there, and he goes, make him wait. So I went, cool, I'll go with that. So I started stretching. I bend down like I'm stretching my hamstrings, I'm touching my toes. Then he goes, okay. And like, go now. But now I'm thinking, no, I got you, bro. Make him wait. Okay. Because now I'm doing a stretch. So I stretch another 10 seconds just to go, I got this, man. I got this. Just that he taught me how to be, like, annoying.
Right, you know? Right.
You know, like, to be a heel. Vince is a master heel, you know.
He's the ultimate heel.
Right.
Hey, go ahead.
I got huge respect for Vince and what he's done. People talk about Vince and they always go, well, is he really, you know, is he really an a-hole? And I go, are you? Because I am. You know, I mean, like, to me, you got to take the good and the bad with people in any kind of a relationship. And I would certainly think the upside of any kind of a relationship I'm ever going to have with Vince McMahon far exceeds any downside, you know? I mean, I think Vince is a genius.
Well, I mean, the thing about Vince is, and the guy is a man of his word. He won't ask you to do anything he won't do. He's fearless, and he just wants success, and he's willing to do whatever it takes to find success. And I think that's, you know, that's just the epitome of a successful businessman or athlete.
Well, now that, to me, Steve, look, I know that you spent a lot of time working with Vince right there on top. In fact, you did we were down there doing our thing here in Atlanta with that NWO. It was the angle that I think that you and Vince started, along with certainly the rest of the supporting cast, but that thing against you and Vince was like one of our number one obstacles, bro, on those Monday Night Wars. But yeah, Vince is—he will take the bump. You can hit him with the chair. The one thing about Vince that I noticed—I'm not sure I was that cool with this—the dude's a cyborg. He does not sleep.
No,
he still trains. He still eats. You know, he's eating his meals. He's going to train hard. But he doesn't sleep, so since he doesn't sleep, he figures you don't need to sleep either. Because
yeah.
You know Vince, brother. You know Vince, coming into a pay-per-view or something, he's not afraid to have you making appearances round the clock.
Right.
And still make the town that night. And you know you got to, for me, I want a tan, I got to hit the gym, you know, blah, blah, blah. I got to get my hair dyed, you know.
But there came a point where, you know, they started taking it, quite frankly, they started taking advantage of the appearance thing. And they're booking guys like crazy. And everybody was almost really afraid to say no. Finally, guys started saying no. Then they started offering a few ducats for the appearances. But they kind of started almost.
Oh, yeah.
Those
I did
things.
A lot of free ones. I'm yeah. sure you did, bro. It, you know, you'd get the memo, but at that time it would come from JJ.
Yeah.
Through like carbon copy and Russo. And it would say, you have been personally selected by Vince to represent the World Wrestling Entertainment at this function.
Almost like it's supposed to be your honor.
Grand opening of some Dunkin' Donuts. So.
Yeah, and you were supposed to be happy about it. Oh, they picked me? Oh,
yeah,
shit,
right.
This is going to be great.
And then be sure to get to the building early because you have a meet and greet, too.
Hey, before we talk about Madison Square Garden and getting ready to wrap up, I want to go right back to Curt Hennig because he said he took you into Vince's office when you dropped the bad guy idea. And when I first rolled into WWF back in the day, it was Curt Hennig who said, hey, kid, come here. I want to introduce you to somebody. He took me into the production truck. He introduced me to Kevin Dunn. He goes, this is a guy you need a relationship right here. And me and KD hooked up and became friends from then on. But that was the kind of guy that Curt Hennig was to take a cat under his wing. And like you said, he carried you for so many years and taught you in the ring and mentored you. But when I first rolled in, seemingly, I'm nobody, yes, but I am competition. And nonetheless, he just extended that olive branch of friendship and guidance and took me right to one of the guys who was one of my most important relationships in the company. And I think just that speaks to the kind of person that Curt Hennig, one of the greatest of all time, was.
Yeah, I agree, Steve. And, you know, one thing Curt taught me was always babyface the crew. You know, not just Kevin Dunn, who's like the main guy up there, but everybody, the camera guy, you know, the dude set up the lighting, everything. He taught me to use these guys as an asset, as a resource. So I would take the guy and go, hey, bro, is there any place special I could stand when I do my interview where you could shoot a bet? And a lot of these guys will go, yeah, actually, if you move up about a foot and hit this light here, or, you know, you talk to the guys with the pyro and stuff, because at that time, like, ooh, I had in-ring pyro, which not many guys had. It's like, ooh. And I would say, like, where should, how close can I get to it without being a problem and this and that? And, you know, and, like, you have the resources of that giant company to help you with things. It just makes being a performer to me at a high level way easier.
Right. Hey, Scott, let's talk real quickly, or not real quickly, but let's jump onto the incident at Madison Square Garden.
Are we talking about the infamous curtain call?
The curtain call.
It even has a name, man.
Yeah, it has a name, and I remember I was like mid-card that night, and I'd worked my match, I'd showered, I stayed. Of course, nobody knew the curtain call was going to happen. I just always stuck around and watched the matches. Everything happens. I only remember what the last match was, but all you guys, it was you, Kevin Nash, Shawn Michaels, X-Pac, and Triple H.
No, actually, Pac wasn't there then.
Pac wasn't there?
He gets a lot of heat for being there.
Okay.
Triple H. I had Goldust. I was on my way out the door. I'd already given my notice and accepted an offer from Turner.
Right.
And so I was going to work with Goldust, who was new to the territory, and put him around. You know, that's the way we do it. I put him over as he's coming in the door, and I'm leaving. But he got injured on a European tour. And so by the time I come back to the States to finish up my last few commitments with Vince, and the part that was so crazy for me, Steve, is, you know, I'm the semi-main, and Kev is the main event. You know, Diesel and Razor are the last two matches of the card, and Vince is not even selling. At this point, we have both given our notice, and he won't, he just doesn't sell. I'm just wishing he'd say, hey, listen, can we talk about this? You know, because I really wanted to stay.
But you guys wanted guaranteed money, as the deal was, and he wasn't going to give guaranteed money, so you guys were going to bolt. Yep. Y'all were waiting for him to come.
I remember asking him almost a year before that time what I could do to, you know, I said, Vince, does my ring work need improvement? You know, and he went, oh, absolutely not. I'm happy with your ring skills. I said, is it my microphone skills? What should I do? Oh, you're one of the best talkers we got. So I'm just curious because, you know, my pay has kind of plateaued over the last few years, and I'm wondering what I could do to make big money like the guys who preceded me. You know, what do I have to do to be successful? I'm asking you to help. And he knew then, you know, like something was up, and he called me in, and we talked about it, and I said, Vince, you know, I want to be here. I want to be part of your team. And it was a private company at that time.
Right.
You know, they weren't public yet. So the way I looked at it is if I made more, Vince made less. It was literally coming out of his pocket in that era. And I said, look, Vince, I know how it works. There's only so much revenue from house shows and pay-per-views. I said, but what about merchandise? You know, can I have more of the merchandise? No. Oh, okay. Well, how about Japan? I still want to work for you. Can I have a 15-week year, go work in Japan, get their money? Like with the merchandise, I said, Vince, if it's the fan buys Razor merchandise, that's their money. Now, let me get that Japanese money. No. So, like, okay. I really just wanted days off. I remember asking Vince, like, thank you for being so generous and paying me so well. But, Vince, what good is the money when I never get to spend it? I'm never home.
Right.
I'm spending all my time entertaining other people's kids, you know. And I got two kids at home that I'm growing estranged from because I'm always gone. But what happened with the curtain call, Steve, is, you know, I wrestled Triple H, who was still doing that rich boy gimmick at that time, that old, you know, polo pants, like, horse thing and, you know, all the bowing. But still a gifted performer. And I was really lucky. I had worked with him. That was on a Sunday. Saturday, we had a double shot. It was Philly Hershey double shot. I worked with Paul both nights. Vince and Pat made those towns, and then, of course, they're at the Garden. And Pat calls me aside in the Garden and wants to change what we've been doing. We're just having a basic little match, then he's beat me with his finish.
Right.
And Pat calls me in and changes the finish. And it was one of the best matches I ever had in my career. Was in the Garden against Triple H that night. And he laid it out to Steve. And what he had us do was when I hit the ring and I'm doing the thing, like handing my chain to Tony Schimmel, Triple H jumps from behind, beats me up, throws me to the floor, chokes me with the table, beats me up in that short runway and leaves me there. Goes back in the ring, gets on the mic, says, you know, Razor Ramon, go wherever it is you're going. Because at that point, you know, the internet wasn't such a huge deal. A lot of the marks, the fans, they didn't know I was leaving. But about half that arena did know.
Yes, they did.
And I'm happy to say, bro, that night, Steve, in the Garden was sold out. was the largest gate non-pay-per-view that the WWE had done at that time. I mean, I really felt good where the company was going. And, like, people are chanting, please don't go.
Right.
I walk to the ring. You know, and we do the match. You know, he beats me up on the floor. I'm laying there, and a lot of fans, you know how it is, Steve. It's always the same fans in the same seats at big venues like the Garden, you know, or the Boston Garden, the same fans. And people are talking to me, going, look at you, Razor. Look how they treat you after everything you've done. Man. Go ahead. Go to Atlanta. Get the money. People are saying that to me. But what Pat had counted on and what worked that night is I'm laying there on the ground, and here comes that sweet Garden crowd. Razor. I hit the ring. Triple H feeds me like a job guy. I mean, bang, 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 flat back, and I do all my signature stuff to him. This is the finish that Pat gave us, and we had Baby Earl Hebner in there, and I think he's a sweet referee.
Oh, yeah.
I'm picking him up for my finish. I'm picking him up for Razor's Edge, which causes his feet to flip over my head. Baby Earl walks behind, boom, takes the bump. He rolls to the ropes. You know, Vince has got that big ring that gives you that extra foot or two to work with. I give Triple H the Razor's Edge, roll over, cover him. I'm not a fan of the guy counting himself. I wait, I get up, go grab Baby Earl, turn around, get kicked in the gut, pedigree, 1, 2, 3. It was so sweet.
Beautiful.
Everybody in that building but me knew that Baby Earl had been bumped.
Yeah.
You know, it was so sweet. Thank you, Pat Patterson. I do the job. I lay there forever. His music's over. He leaves. As I stand up, Steve, you know how sweet that New York crowd is. They all start chanting, "You sold out. You sold out." And I remember I didn't have a microphone then, but I remember pointing right at Vince as he's standing outside the curtain at that short aisle.
Yeah.
And I said, "I pantomime. You tell him, give me the money, I'll stay right here." And Vince just looked down. So then I remember, you know, now I'm feeling like such a mark for myself. I grabbed the mic, and my standard gimmick was say hello to the bad guy. I go, "Stay," and I go, "Goodbye, Steve." And I swear half that crowd went, "Goodbye to the bad guy." So I leave. Now it's intermission. Vince, like I said, has never sold the fact that I'm leaving. He hasn't said, "Hey, can we talk? Hey, come on, stay here." Nothing. In fact, he's mad. He's mad at me for giving my notice, which I never really figured out.
Right.
But, you know, like, hey, it wasn't like I want a new contract. So I just don't want this one to roll over. Can we talk?
Right.
That's the topic. But he got, like, it's like I stood him up at the prom. He got mad at me. And, but so, finally, now I'm summoned to his office there in the Garden. They go, "Vince wants to see you." I walk in, and he's talking to me. "Darn it, you still work for me. Let's work something out." I said, "Vince, I don't know. I've already told Bishop I'm coming tomorrow. It's a little late for this. You know, where were you months ago?"
Vince is so good at putting the pressure on, isn't he?
Yeah, well, he's doing his thing. You know, he's working me, bro, because right. I want to stay there. I love that place.
Yeah.
I just rocked Madison Square Garden and got a new guy over, like
right.
crazy. You know what I mean? And I'm part of the team, bro. I feel like I'm part of the team, and I'm like, I consider myself a utility player.
Right.
I can almost play every position. But anyway, I'm in there. Vince and I are having this discussion. In walks Shawn, who's a dear friend of mine. In walks Shawn Michaels. "Hey, Vince, do you mind if Ray's and Triple H come out after my match?" They're setting up the cage where, you know, Shawn worked against Diesel in the cage that night and took the, you know, Kev took the gin music. He's down. Shawn wants me to come out. I go strolling down the aisleway. Now, Sean's alone in this ring. I got a good history with Shawn overall, and particularly in Madison Square Garden. So I go stepping through that rage, the cage, and the people are working, like they're rumbling. I'm
right.
looking at Shawn like, "I might jump your little ass." And he just runs over and hugs me, kisses me, which kind of killed the whole,
right.
the whole story I was telling. But, yeah, it morphed into this big hug fest, and a lot of guys were really angry, like we were trying to hurt the business. I want to go on the record saying that was nobody's intention. It just kind of morphed into this big thing. And to me, I felt like I'm never going to see these fans in Madison Square Garden again. And so I want to say goodbye to them and thanks for your support. And, you know, the four of us, Steve, have never been, well, the five of us, if you count Pac, have never been together one time since that night.
That is amazing. But you know what happened out of that, Scott, was when you guys were going to go down south, and whoever you guys were talking to, who was it? Was it Bischoff down there?
Yeah.
And you guys were going to go down there and get guaranteed money, correct?
Right.
Man, this
and Steve, guaranteed work schedule, not some whenever we need to thing. It's like, for X amount of days, I get X compensation and X, you know, travel, X, you know what I mean, cars, hotels.
And this is unprecedented. This is never before done.
The main thing that attracted me, Steve, was the less work.
It was less work, but the point I'm trying to make it was this had never been done before. You guys set the precedent that, you know, that's when guaranteed contracts were born, after you guys did the hug fest, bolted, and got guaranteed money. It changed the face of the game. Down in WCW, it changed the face of the game in WWF, which would become WWE. Before then, there was no such thing as a guaranteed contract until you guys walked.
Actually, that's very true, Steve. And I'm happy that if I benefited the other boys in some way, then, you know, I'm happy for that.
Hey, man, after you guys hugged and tying this thing up just with this story, when you guys hugged and you all left and you got in your rental cars and headed out, what was your feeling? Because, you know, dude, Madison Square Garden is a very special place. Those fans are just, you know, the best in the world. And, you know, if you can get over in front of a Garden crowd, you can get over anywhere because those people are tough. And it's not like a Nassau Coliseum crowd or a Meadowlands crowd. You know, the Garden is a Garden. So what were you thinking after all that goes down? You're a utility player. You're on the team, and now you're walking off. What was in your head?
Really bittersweet, Steve. To me, I don't know if you're familiar with Tracy Chapman, but at that time she had a hit song, and it was, "Give me one reason to stay here,
right,
and I'll turn right back around." I asked the guys playing the music to play that for me that night because I wanted to send a message of it. It's like, give me one reason to stay here, and I'll turn right back around. Like, I don't want to leave, but Vince, you're going to ask me to stay. And because it wasn't about the money for me, it was about, sure, let's get this money thing taken care of. How about easing up on that work schedule? I don't want to make every little town. Can't these young guys make it?
Right.
You know, let the young guys go to these nothing happening towns. You know, let the old timers make the big towns. Or I don't know what I was thinking, but when I left, and it was, now it's done. It's a done deal. Vince talked to me. I talked to Vince. I shaked his hand. He wished me luck. I wished him continued success. And now we're all piled in the car, and we had a band because we had I think we had Justin Credible with us too. So we used to get a big band. We call it the Hose Wagon. So I think we usually made Triple H drive because, you know, he didn't drink.
Right.
So he's driving. I think I'm Shawn Michaels might be sitting shotgun. Kevin and I in the back. We got PJ stuffed in the back. Young boy looks like a beer cooler. And, you know, of course, there comes that time we've got to sit around and put ourselves over and talk about how great we are. So yeah, we did that for most of the ride. But then, for me, sinking in, you know how, like, driving around that city, and you know how when you leave the Garden, in that era, we left in an ambulance. You know, when you're on the lake, everybody piles in an ambulance. I don't know if they did it when you were there, but we'd all pile in an ambulance that drove us away from the building.
You had to be in an ambulance to get out of the building, because if you pulled through in your town car, they would rip your mirrors off. And this was if they loved you as a babyface or they hated you as a heel, they would rip your windshield wipers off, your rear view mirrors, and you were proud of it if you were over, but you still had to pay for the damage to the rental car.
Yeah,
so you had to be snuck out in an ambulance. It was great.
When you rent the car, go ahead and get the extra insurance.
You got to.
Yeah, but it was just great. And I felt bittersweet, Steve. I had no idea that, you know, any of that NWO stuff was going to work. You know, I had never even talked to Eric Bischoff on the phone. It was all handled through lawyers and agents. So I had no idea what was going to happen. I really felt uncertain about what was going to happen to me creatively. Was I going to be satisfied that way? But I knew at least I was going to be able to provide for me and mine, you know. And so, yeah, it wasn't a very good feeling. That's when I dealt with the business side of show business for the first time. It wasn't so much about the performance in the show to me. It became more about the business, the actual dollars spent.
Well, you know what? With that being said, with you not knowing what was going to happen when you went down to WCW, I'm inviting you right now to come back on the show, continue our conversation, and go into Scott Hall Part 2 so we can further cover your career. I want to talk a lot more about your days in AWA. I want to talk about your association with Curt Hennig, who's one of my favorites of all time. So we can cover a lot more material in the future. But on this note, let's go ahead and ride off into the sunset. And before I give you your last chance to talk to these people before we sign off, you can follow Scott Hall on Twitter at Scott Hall NWO. You can follow his young son, young Cody Hall, who's making his mark in the world of pro wrestling. See what kind of path he can go down. You can follow him at Cody_Hall. And for bookings and information, reach out to Scott, scott@razorforlife.com. Hey, Scott, I appreciate you coming on the show, man. I'm a big mark for you back in the day. And with all the conversations we've had, I just wish we'd have crossed paths and started talking a lot sooner.
Well, heck, it's not too late for that now, man. You know, if you need somebody to help shovel out dolls or something down there at the Broken Skull Ranch, I got a big old redneck kid who can help you out, man.
Well,
thanks for having me, Steve. Thanks to Mo and everybody in the studio. It was a pleasure, Steve. And I got to say, Saturday nights I find myself sitting in front of my TV tuned to CMT watching Redneck Island, man.
Words I love to hear, man. I've been talking to Scott Hall. He's going to come back on the show. And Scott, thanks for coming. I'll call you back in just a little bit.
Thanks, Steve. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show. Please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends. For more Steve Austin Show, go to podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.